Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin another week. This morning, in the first part of the program, we'll be talking about the tobacco industry and the safety of tobacco use, among other things. And our guest for this program is Dr. Jeffrey Wigand. He is perhaps the most highly placed former industry official to come out, talk publicly about the industry, what they knew, and when they knew it. And as a matter of fact, if you saw the film The Insider that came out last year, you saw a dramatic version of his story and what happened to him. He was, for a number of years, employed by the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company. That's from December of 88 through March of 1993. Before that, he worked in some other healthcare companies, including Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer. After his falling out with Brown and Williamson, we'll tell you about how that happened, he went on to cooperate with the government investigating the tobacco industry. He also came to national prominence in 1995 when he went public with what he knew in an interview with CBS that was taped for the program 60 Minutes. And in fact, it probably got much more attention and much more play because of the decision by CBS not to use the interview they did, because the network was afraid that it would be sued by Brown and Williamson. Eventually, that story got out and the piece ran. He was sued by Brown and Williamson because of his public disclosures about the industry. Eventually, the lawsuit was dismissed as a condition of the tobacco settlement between the attorneys general of 40 states and the industry. And now he continues to travel around the country talking about smoking and tobacco and also working with an organization that he formed called Smoke Free Kids Incorporated. And as the name would suggest, the idea is they're trying to find ways to prevent kids from smoking. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and was good enough to come and spend some time with us, and we're pleased to have him here. The number, if you'd like to call in at some point, if you'd like to ask questions, we welcome that, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And all we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can accommodate as many different folks as possible, but anyone's welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being
here. Good morning.
Here.
Thank you. Thank you for not arranging snow.
Well, you may just have dodged it. You never can tell this part of the country. And I know you live in Charleston, so
yeah,
you probably don't see much snow.
Well, actually, the eastern coast from North Carolina didn't dodge it yesterday. They got a dose of it.
Well, I've been in South Carolina in the summertime, and I don't envy you at that time of year, maybe other times of year.
Yeah, I mean, July and August just, you know, stretches me just a little bit, but it's from air-conditioned home to air-conditioned car to air-conditioned something.
Uh-huh. And are you still teaching?
I'm still teaching mainly I spend my time with K through 6 kids. So I'm not teaching in the traditional sense of being in the same classroom, teaching the same subjects every day. What I teach children, mainly K through 6, is enabling skills to help them make healthy, responsible choices and recognize the targeting of an industry that gets 3,000 kids a day addicted. And it is giving them a competency of understanding what goes on in the movies. Is it real, unreal? What is subliminal manipulation versus what is fact? How the industry behaved? And also, at the same time, engendering in them the opportunity to become activists and fight for social change.
Well, I want to give people a chance to hear sort of the basics of what happened to you if they're not familiar with this story. Let me ask first, when you went to work for Brown and Williamson, why you took that job? Why go to work for a tobacco company after having worked in the healthcare field elsewhere?
Well, I mean, I spent 6 months of interviews with Brown and Williamson and its parent company, BAT Industries, which is the second largest tobacco concern in the world. Pretty diversified. Brown & Williamson was the nation's third largest. And it originally started out with them approaching me and asking me if I could use my scientific skills that I had amassed for 25 years in the healthcare arena to address a product when used as intended, kills 430,000 people a year. And I guess after 6 months of interviews, I believed that I would have the opportunity to apply my science and my background to a product that I believe people would continue to use as adults. And that if I can make it safer, that is, reduce the risk, but also recognize that there's no such thing as a safe tobacco product, I would be doing something that I believe was making a difference and socially relevant. Mm-hmm. And so I left the healthcare industry that environment that I'd worked in, and joined them in January of 1989, and left precipitously in March of 1993. And there were lots of things that I saw during my tenure in the company that gave me considerable pause for thought. The Safer Cigarette project was canceled and shifted overseas, like many other things that went on, because of the concern about unraveling the fundamental tenets by which the industry survived five decades of litigative actions. Of one, there is no causal hypothesis or process between smoking and health, something that they generated controversy over, and that smoking was an addictive, and that it was a free choice. And what I saw was basically an attempt to foster that by generating controversy in science, by not pursuing a safer cigarette, which would said that everything they said before was what? Was fundamentally a lie. And that the whole idea of going from a high tar to a light product, the Monica meaning some aspect of health, safety, a reduced risk, was also a mischaracterization in the broadest sense. So many things led me to do what I did. I mean, I was also paid well. I mean, I'll be very honest with you. I was paid extremely well. I was paid well over $300,000 a year in salary, which is something more than I had been traditionally making, but not, you know, I didn't jump automatically into six-figure salary. I had some personal issues that were addressed. I had two young children, 2 months old and 2 years old. And I wanted to move them from the New York City metropolitan area to an environment that was a little bit more less risky in that way. Mm. And also my ex-wife was from Louisville, Kentucky, and her parents were there. And I felt, wow, that's a great opportunity that my children also have interactions with their grandparents. I was paid well. I thought I would be making a social difference. It was a unique technical challenge, and I believed I could have done it. And so I put it all together, and ultimately in December of 98, I chose to accept the job. Yeah.
So it sounds like by the time then that you left there, you were disillusioned, you were unhappy, really unhappy with the company. You were ready to leave, you were fired, right?
Technically speaking, I was fired, yes. And it was, I mean, there are many, many incidents over the time period I was there. I mean, first of all, I mean, it didn't take me about 10 months to see some of the things that really caused me pause for thought. That is, I mean, we attended a meeting for 4.5 days of all the scientists throughout BAT Industries to address how to make a safer product, how to make a fire-safe product, how to reduce the addictive quality of nicotine, deal with environmental tobacco smoke, deal with genetic engineering, and the testing associated with measuring some degree of safety, and how to address moving the product from outside the domain of any regulatory to something that ultimately would probably be regulated by the FDA. And the minutes clearly reflected the enunciation of what was the consistent and conscious mantra within the company, where we're in a nicotine delivery business and tar is a negative baggage and that nicotine's addictive, but outside nicotine was there for taste. And this meeting really addressed this issue. We could make a safer cigarette using extant technology. There was a capacity to change nicotine's addictiveness, and it all was reflected in some 15 pages of minutes. And when these minutes were circulated through the senior management, they ordered an attorney who did not participate in the meeting to change the minutes of the meeting so they would not be discoverable in a court of law. And that really gave me real pause for thought. Mm. And then it was followed up by a process by which lawyers were put in every facet of science. They were editing, vetting, choosing which science was read by the scientists, which documents were read, and it became pretty oppressive in that way. I chose at the time, though, because I had a family and mortgage, and I had a daughter that also was needed consistent as well as daily medical help, that I could not afford to, at least that time, put my family in harm's way. So I basically stayed there, continued to get the salary, continued to do what I thought was changing things from inside, and ultimately ran into a real buzzsaw with the use of an additive that had been removed from cigarettes in the 80s because it was shown to be hepatotoxic in dogs and mass foul odors. and the company continued to use it, its pipe tobacco, irrespective of being removed from the FDA's grass list, but continued to use it because it didn't have to disclose it to the government. And it had taken it out of cigarettes, and it was shown to be a lung-specific carcinogen in laboratory testing of mice and rats by the NTP program. And when I went to the same officer of the company, who was my boss, that ordered the change of the minutes of the meeting from 12 and a half, 14 pages down to 2.5 pages of vanilla, he told me to go back to the laboratory and find a substitute that he wasn't going to take it out because it affects sales and profits. And I guess that was the rubber that really hit the road for me at that time. And I had trouble enough dealing with some of the things I had learned and observed and saw, plus my own kids who were coming home from private schools that I was able to afford were asking me why I was killing people with the job I did. So, I mean, I had a really kind of Waterloo coming to the, I don't know, I can't quite, I mean, anyway, there was a significant conflict. The guy I debated with was Tommy Sandifer, who was the president and chief operating officer. I would say it's probably a little bit stronger than a debate because I believe that there was enough duty of care to be demonstrated here that when it was incrementally risky, why continue to use it? Ultimately, he became the new CEO several months later, and I was summarily fired. And that's the way it ended.
Let me, at this point, just reintroduce for anybody who might have tuned in here. We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, former chief scientist at Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation, who, as I mentioned at the beginning, came to national prominence. His story became a national story about 5 years ago when he became the industry's highest-ranking former executive to publicly talk about health and smoking issues. He was featured in a segment of 60 Minutes that initially was produced, put together with him in it. Then CBS decided they thought they'd be sued by Brown & Williamson. They pulled him out, but eventually word got out of what CBS had done, caused great embarrassment to CBS News, to 60 Minutes. Then they actually ran the piece.
Well, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, maybe I should just characterize the environment in CBS and give you a little bit of different texture to this.
Sure.
CBS, well, first of all, ABC in August of 1995 apologized to Philip Morris during an acquisition of ABC by Disney. And that was there was a $10 billion lawsuit on between Philip Morris and ABC Day One for saying that nicotine was addictive and that Philip Morris spiked their cigarettes with nicotine. That was a lawsuit based on libel. Philip Morris sued ABC. That during the acquisition of ABC by Disney, ABC apologized and withdrew part of its statement about spiking, apologized to Philip Morris for not accurately depicting properly, using the proper word. They probably shouldn't have said the word spike. They probably should have used the word manipulate. But they apologized. First time ever. Well, on August 5th of 1995, I recorded with CBS 60 Minutes my interview, which basically dealt with the issue of the CEOs lying in front of Congress, manipulating nicotine, using chemicals to manipulate it, and a myriad of other issues. And part of my agreement with CBS when I did it was they would provide me or give me opportunity, and I would maintain custody control of the taping until such time as I found a lawyer, because I couldn't find a lawyer in Kentucky before, and that I had some form of physical security for my family because we already had two death threats against my children because I started cooperating with Congress's investigation in April of 1994 with the Waxman Committee on tobacco matters. And so I was real concerned about going public without having some sort of safety net, so to speak. But at the same time, CBS interviewed me. They were being acquired by Westinghouse. And this is something that doesn't come out too much in the media. And that there was a significant opportunity for those who in CBS, major corporate, to make substantial amount of money based on the equity and the stock. And should there be any detractors from the balance sheet, that would affect people's earnings, number one. Number two is the owner of CBS and it's his brother were under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice for perjury in front of Congress. Well, that's kind of strange for a CBS executive to be under investigation for perjury. Well, problem is that not only he was the owner through Lowe's Corporation of a tobacco company called Lorillard, which is like also something not well known outside the movie and the media. And the third thing that really makes it very much more interesting is that Brown and Williamson, my former employer, was negotiating with Lorillard Tobacco Company for the transfer of $100 million worth of product to Lorillard. And now the lawyers within CBS BlackRock are evaluating, should they air this controversial, how to deal with the issue of the perjury with their Tisch et al., how to deal with an unfettered balance sheet, and how to make it culminate the transfer product from Brown and Williamson to Lorillard. Well, some way magically, Brown and Williamson learns of the interview and threatens CBS during this acquisition process with a $15 billion-ish lawsuit that would have great impact on the acquisition and would just spotlight a lot of things. CBS, BlackRock lawyers that were involved in all these elements chose to kill the interview with me under the threat of Brown and Williamson suing them under a specious legal principle called tortious interference. That is, the news agency enticed me to break my confidentiality agreement to give them news. Well, I've never heard. That's what a news agency does. Anyway, in October of 1995, CBS and CBS News canceled the interview and acceded to the threat, as well as I think some other issues here that probably, as well as some greed, I think, and canceled the interview. That was fine. I mean, but that's not all that would happen. Somebody within CBS also then wound up leaking the complete transcript of the August 5th interview to the New York media. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, bedlam broke out. I was sued immediately, ex parte in a Kentucky court. I was enjoined, and the fireworks began. I must say that CBS did honor part of their agreement with me at the time. They did provide me and my family with physical security. But that didn't. I mean, the whole issue broke out. And it wasn't until after, well, so CBS canned the program. They acknowledged nothing in terms of the program. Then in November of 1995, I gave a sworn deposition in Mississippi, which was the same under oath, the same thing I told CBS on August 5th. That was under seal by order of the Supreme Court of the state of Mississippi at the request of Brown and Williamson. They want to quash that deposition. Well, it went forward under lots of threats of going to jail for contempt in Kentucky court, etc. And it was sealed. That means nobody could read it in the public until or unless you had the right of visibility of that deposition through court order or because you're involved. Well, some way or another, that deposition, a sealed deposition, made its way to the Wall Street Journal. And the Wall Street Journal chose, under also the same threat, to publish it. And they published it in January of 1996. Not only did they publish it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, which one would not expect the Wall Street Journal to do, who's sort of the purveyor of corporate and business, yeah, published it under the threat, and they also loaded it up on the Internet. In February of 1996, CBS then, when the threat of tortious interference was removed, then aired the August 5th, 1995 interview.
Interview with you. So finally aired the piece as they originally had planned
to do. Yes. And it was, I mean, I think if one reflects back on that, it is not a great day for journalism in a sense. And I mean, if you look at all the very complicated peripheral issues and some of the issues there, not only can this industry intimidate not only individuals, but now can it go past and intimidate another major corporation by using its legal power? And this is an industry that spends $600 million a year in legal fees outside its own walls to make sure that it continues the controversy, continues escaping from the bar of justice, now has effectively intimidated a company and an industry that I think that has had a stellar reputation for investigative and hard reporting, particularly CBS 60 Minutes.
Hmm. One of the things I wonder about is if, I guess this is one of those sort of what if kind of deals, if after you had left Brown & Williamson, if the you hadn't felt they were threatening you and that perhaps your life and the lives of your family were endangered, whether you would have gone as far in coming out publicly as you had. Say if the just for imagination's sake, if the company had just left you alone, would you have done what you did?
Wow. Probably so, but I mean, there was a whole pattern of intimidation. I mean, first of all, they sued me in September of 1993 after me trying to get them to honor their severance agreement. And to me, my severance agreement revolved around two things. I needed some money to continue to keep my family afloat while I got a new job. And two is I was very intimately linked to my health care benefits, particularly for one of my children who was born with spina bifida. And so I couldn't have that. I just couldn't do that. And they wouldn't honor their original agreement. I couldn't get a lawyer in Kentucky. And I finally, when I left in March, I ironed it out an agreement in June of 1993 without a lawyer. In September of 1993, they sue me, stop my health care benefits, stop my salary, until I signed a more onerous, draconian-type secrecy agreement, which basically said I couldn't talk about tobacco without first talking to them first, a lawyer present, et cetera, et cetera. And by any standard, this was most draconian, even by the tobacco industry. And, of course, what I did is I signed it. I could not let my family go in harm's way. And then I got involved with CBS in January of 94 about the fire-safe cigarette and the ability of the industry to make a fire-safe cigarette. And I saw documents that really kind of disturbed me, that they had the capacity to make a fire-safe cigarette. And in June of 1986, they chose not to do it because there was no legislation. There's between 1,200 to 1,500 lives lost each year because of fires created by cigarettes. And they didn't introduce the law, the technology, because there was no laws or regulations. They called it Hamlet, to burn or not to burn. And that bothered me. It bothered me then to watch the seven CEOs get up in front of Congress and all swear that nicotine wasn't addictive and smoking was no more dangerous than Twinkies. And that bothered me. And then I got to see through Stanton Glantz, a professor at UC San Francisco, the complete chronology and history of the from the 50s through just shortly before I joined Brown & Williamson, the things I asked to see when I was in a company on nicotine addiction and targeting and all that stuff that one would like to see as a head scientist and a vice president of research and development, which was what I was, I got to see from the first time. And you know, that combined with my own moral compass, my children, what I thought was the right thing to do, what the public needed to know, I chose to do it. Now, if they didn't push me, would I have done it? And the same events happened. If they didn't push me and I saw the same, most likely my moral compass would have made me think that was the right thing to do and probably would have done it. Mm-hmm. Was it complicated with lots of other events? Yes, it was. I mean, CBS made its own events. Philip Morris made part of its events. The congressional investigation, the FDA's investigation, the death threats, the bullet in the mailbox. I mean, all this stuff contributed to the final, I hate to use the word solution, but final end of what happened here. I mean, to have bodyguards when you go and teaching high school is not what I would consider fun.
You made reference to the fact that a lot of industry documents had previously been secret, had come out, and this was another. There was another guy, if I remember the story right, it was a guy who was working as a legal aide who
Merrill
came across
Williams.
The stuff. He found it, was horrified. He made copies of all this stuff, and he was the guy who sent it to. Was it he who sent it to Stanton Glantz?
No, I mean, I don't think the pathway is pretty. I mean, Merrill Williams took the documents, which was a very noble thing what he did. It really shone the light on about five decades of lawyer manipulation, science controversy generated about the science, deception, etc. And he brought it forward. But his initial was to try to extort money from him, which was the wrong thing to do. Congress wouldn't touch the documents because they were stolen. Lawyers wouldn't touch it because they were stolen. And they still, but they finally made it. And Stan Glantz at UC San Francisco chose to make them public.
He put them up on the internet,
and he wrote a book about it. He published seven papers in the Journal of American Medical Association, and it wasn't without threat. I mean, they went out and they tried to enjoin him. They've tried to take his research grants away from him because he shone the light on the truth. If it wasn't for those documents, I think, I mean, each piece of this puzzle has a certain part in forming the whole image. But would one make the difference to the other? If I didn't see the Merrill Williams documents, would it make a difference? Yeah, I saw those and I said, God, that's the same thing that I saw. And now I'm the credible, I have credible knowledge, I have the facts, I was a witness to this.
Well, the thing that I was curious about, when you were working as a scientist for Brown and Williamson, did you know that that existed, but you couldn't see it? Or did you say, you know, have we done research on this? And the company said, no. Or I guess I'm just curious about, or did they just say to you, oh, yeah, we have this stuff, but you can't see it?
Well, first of all, I mean, there was stuff I asked for that I thought was the normal, what would be the normal background information that you would assume that would be existing in the files of the product. I mean, I've spent years doing product development and product innovation, and I knew what the base information should be. When I asked for it, they said it didn't exist. Yet I would go to meetings and I listened to people talk about things and said, wow, where does this come from? And I never saw it. I mean, even I asked to see it. I was told it didn't exist. And then to see it 3 years later, and it was exactly the things I asked for, exactly the same thing, and the manner in which they were sequestered, vetted, kept away from the public domain, information that could have been shared with the 64 Surgeon General's report, information that should have been shared with consumers so they knew how they were manipulating nicotine and why they added additives to it to facilitate addiction, I think is information that should have been shared with the public, that they knew clearly in the 50s that nicotine was addictive and they were in a covert pharmaceutical business, yet they would swear, not only in public, but also in legal proceedings and credit card, that it wasn't addictive.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I get a caller here I want to try to get to, and I think, again, I should introduce our guest. I'm talking with Dr. Jeffrey Wigand. He's a former chief scientist for the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation, who became the highest-ranking industry official to go public with what he knew about the industry, about tobacco. He came to national prominence in 1995 when he taped an interview, which then, as we've explained, was later aired for 60 Minutes. And if you saw the film The Insider that came out last year, that was a dramatic version of his story, but one that he says essentially is the way it was.
Very accurate.
If you have questions, we'd be happy to hear from you. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Southern Illinois on our toll free line.
How you doing? I'm glad that you had the courage to do that, and I hope you can go on and encourage others in other industries, because you know there are other industries as well harming public people as this tobacco industry, and I want to make that point. But I wanted to ask you a question, and that was, how long is it that this settlement is expected to take to pay off? Is it like 10 years or something like that before they're done paying the states all this money, the tobacco industry?
Well, the industry and the state attorney generals in their lawsuits reached an agreement in June 20 of 1997, in which only four states participated: Mississippi, Florida, Texas, and Minnesota. There's a separate agreement that covers the remaining states in November of 1998, which amounted to $246 billion paid over 25 years to the states for compensation of health care costs that were caused as a result of smoking that the state paid. That money has basically been recouped by the industry by passing on immediately after a price increase on cigarettes, which will realize the $246 billion being covered within the first 5 years, and then the resultant 20 years would be cash flow to the industry. That settlement funds have been a source of what I would say to me is a severe disappointment, because the spirit intended by which the attorney generals entered the lawsuit was not only to recover the financial issues, but also to make a better and brighter future for the 3,000 kids a day that this industry togs and addicts. 90% of today's smokers all started before the age of 18.
That's exactly what I wanted to get to, is after they've paid their dues, you know they're not going to lower their prices, and then they're just going to be making a ton of money then on top of what that. So in a sense,
well, we know is as they raise the price of cigarettes and tobacco products, the acceptability and the access to the younger set is dramatically decreased. For every 10% increase in price, we see a 0.4% decrease in youth under the age of 18 ability to purchase the product. So price is one way of putting it out of the reach, not only of kids, but also making it a much more expensive addiction.
Well, I know a family, and I'm trying to encourage my friend to quit smoking, you know, not because of the price, but because of his health, but also because of the price, because as much as he smokes, he can almost make his mortgage payment and cigarette payments, and his child is doing without in some cases. But the one thing other I want to say, and I'll hang up and let somebody else have a chance, and that is, I see the alcohol industry doing just the same thing. There's many people getting killed, and there's a lot, it contributes to more violence than the cigarettes do. And you know, and these drugs that are illegal, you know, alcohol is just as equally contributable to that violence, I think, in my mind, as being a recovered alcoholic. I can testify to that.
And, yeah, well, I think what you need to look at is just the numbers. There are 430,000 people die of tobacco-related diseases. You'll find out that there are tens of thousands of people die from alcohol and alcohol-related diseases. And I'm not going to say dismiss alcohol, but I would say in terms of priorities, and what I would like to think people would like to address is, how do you help those 430,000 people by preventing something that's thought as a pediatric disease? Kids can't go in and buy alcohol legally. They can go in and they can get tobacco products and get on gateway products and start and get hooked early on, and we need to be doing something about that, not only through education but also through legislature.
I appreciate the comment of the caller, and I got somebody else here I want to get to, but just I wonder, just to pick up on that for a second, I think you've made the point that a lot of anti-smoking advocates make. The one thing that you can do to try to keep kids from smoking is to make the product more expensive, so it's harder for them to afford, and enforce the law. And here in this state, for example, you got to be 18, and you can do that. But you know, also, I guess the bottom line should be that you ought to be able to persuade kids, look, this is not good for you. It's bad for your health. So don't do it. And yet, that seems like that's the hardest part.
And I mean, what I try to do, and what a lot of other is create through cognitive processing and science, changes in attitude and behavior, which is basically giving the children the right knowledge, so they're not duped and manipulated by the advertising. What I mean, to advertise to a 13-year-old girl who's developing and her physical appearance becomes a preeminent entity in her life, that if you have a cigarette rather than a sweet, you will what? And what is the message there? And then to have the cigarettes thin and to have the models of it. What 13-year-old girl is not going to succumb to that? And then the process of becoming part of a group, the group that smokes, and then being in that group and then choosing not. But this is an industry that dupes and manipulates children with image and then hooks them with an addictive substance. So there's a whole myriad of things that need to be done to really make a better, brighter future for our children. One is price. Two is compliance. Three is education. Four is cessation. And lots of things that we need to do that we know that work in Florida. I mean, Florida's got a 54% reduction in smoking incidents among middle and high school kids because of a program of investing the funds. Mississippi, 18%. California, double digits. And now we're seeing some of the effects of California's longstanding program in lung cancer. And there's lots of states, Massachusetts, Arizona, that have really embraced making changes in the process by educating our children to be much more capable and able to make good, cognitive, healthy decisions, not based by intimidation you're going to die, based on being manipulated, duped, and tricked at an early age in an addiction that leads ultimately to the horrific statistics. I mean, that is not it. There are more people who die from tobacco each year related diseases than wars, AIDS, suicides, homicides, alcohol related diseases combined. And we tend to treat it as a non-vector of travesty.
Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking that you've probably helped save hundreds of thousands of lives, yet your salary, it sounds like, has dropped below six figures. And Kirkland & Ellis, Kenneth Starr's old law firm, and Brown & Williamson continue to, you know, rake in the money. It's just so... You know, it's really pretty corrupt, and it's wonderful that you were able to resist the kind of corruption that everybody else seems to fall prey to. I have two questions, really. One is, I was wondering if you followed the Whitaker Archer Daniels Midland thing closely. Did it, you know, resonate with you, and do you think it hurt your cause in any way?
I haven't followed it, quite frankly, and I just have not been involved. And I could probably could. I'm vaguely aware of it, but it's not something that really is on my radar screen. And quite frankly, I work with kids every day, and my issues and my dedication is to giving kids a better, brighter future by giving them enabling knowledge today that affects their choices.
Okay. And the other question I had was, I was wondering if, is there anything you could say about the way Brown and Williamson binds and selects executives such that they're the sort that won't rock the boat? I guess what I'm asking is, did you see any common traits or maybe history among the top executives as to perhaps the schools they went to or their attitudes or whatever?
Well, I mean, the industry generally hires people that are preeminently qualified, for one. They pay a very substantial premium price. They're also, at least in the science functions, there are many silos of information that are not shared across many of the participants in the various areas. It's very, I mean, I came to the industry not after 25 years in the industry, but with a totally different perspective. And I think people in the industry become very insensitive and believe it's a right of free choice and they're making jobs. And it's an inculcation in a culture that in many ways is absence of some cultural responsibilities. I mean, I don't know the way to say it. Without.
So it's the place itself that really inculcates.
I think it's the environment, the economics, the belief in social that the right of free choice, and it's a mantra that's built from the day you walk in to the day you die. Plus, the people are very economically rewarded. When you make $40,000-$50,000, when the average income in your environment is $11,000, you have real pause for thought.
Thank you.
Particularly if you have a family.
Thanks for the call. You, I mean, in addition to having a drastic drop-off in your income, your entire life was sort of laid open to public inspection. Your marriage got wrecked. You went through an awful lot, and in that interview that you did with Mike Wallace, it was on 60 Minutes, he asked you something like, you know, so if you had to do it over again, would you? And I think you gave a pretty honest answer that said, well, you know, I don't know. Sometimes I'm not so sure. And now, having gone through everything that you went through, do you still sort of say, well, you know, some days I guess I'm not so sure?
No, I think my answer today is much more concrete than it was at that time. I mean, that was in August of 95. Many of the things that were going on at the time had not happened yet. Mm-hmm. Today, I mean, I have a different perspective, much more information and data. I mean, I have no regrets. I would certainly do it again. It's made my pillow easy to put my head on at night. The mirror is clearer. If my marriage was one that was solid and would not without some, it would have withstood the storm and been better. That's a regret I have. I don't know if I could change that. I mean, it's a remarkable chemistry of what's happened, or a remarkable alignment of stars that led all of us. I mean, I should make it very clear that there was lots of support for this. The 153 kids I was teaching every day, the attorney generals of various states, my own daughters, my family, that gave me tremendous amount of unwavering support. So lots of help, and I have no regrets. I mean, I really don't. And whether it's $300,000 a year now or $30,000 a year now, it doesn't really matter to me, surprisingly, at my tender age. I'm not cranked with that. I mean, I feel very comfortable in what I'm doing. I believe what I'm doing has social relevance. It's something that I have believed I can make a difference in. I will continue making a difference one day at a time, one kid at a time, every day. And I will continue to do that and hopefully engender in other people the same fire to go out and do the same type of work. And it's really directed towards making our children have a better, brighter future, particularly some at-risk kids.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, former chief scientist at Brown and Williamson Tobacco, He, as I mentioned here a couple of times, achieved some national prominence about 5 years ago when he became the industry's highest-ranking former executive to talk publicly about health and smoking, did an interview with the folks at CBS that eventually aired as part of 60 Minutes, and his story, a version of his life story, presented in the film that came out last year, The Insider. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, I've just been handed here a news bulletin coming off of the Associated Press. In a victory for George W. Bush, the U.S. Supreme Court has overturned the Florida Supreme Court decision extending the deadline for certifying the presidential election. That's all we have right at the moment. We'll have news for you from National Public Radio at 1 minute past the hour, and I'm certain throughout the day here we'll have more on this story at the point that we go to NPR for All Things Considered, if not a little bit sooner. But again, this was based on the arguments that took place last week in the United States Supreme Court. The court overturned the Florida Supreme Court decision extending the deadline for certifying the presidential election. And again, we'll have more on that later. I did just want to ask you here on, you know, in front of the microphone, because I did ask before we got talking here about your reaction to the film, which I admitted I had just, I because I knew I was going to talk to you, I ran out and rented it so I could watch it. And it's at the end of the movie, there's some statement, something like, you know, for dramatic effect, events may have been changed or something like that. But you're, when I asked you about it, you said essentially that's pretty, you know, when you look at the essence of it, that's pretty much the way that it was.
Yeah, I mean, the movie is a drama. It is not a documentary or a docudrama. It's about 5 years of many people's lives condensed into 2.5 hours. It has the social relevance of other movies that is probably unparalleled in, like, All the President's Men. The psychology, the philosophy, the emotional aspects of it are all spot on, or very accurate. There is juxtaposition of the chronology of certain events that were used for dramatic effect. Was I ever followed to a golf course like it was? No. Was I followed by an ex-FBI agent, an employee of Brown and Williamson? Yes. Does that scene capture that emotional aspect of being followed and violated? I think it does. I mean, but I have a prism that's somewhat different than a lot of people. But those who choose to read the historical background and then see the movie find, wow, it's a little bit too eerie and close to reality for being a drama. But it is. It has. And I think the movie has, while I had nothing to do with it, let me make that clear, in terms of making it or what came out of it, has tremendous social relevance. It is. The movie has shown a light on how this industry or an industry will intimidate and will breach the trust that we believe that is in the First Amendment of freedom of the press.
Yeah. So, and for you, other than this being, in a sense, also some vindication, did you get anything out of it?
No, I didn't get anything
out
of it.
They didn't write you a check or anything like that?
No, no check to Jeff Wigand. I mean, it is a vindication. It is the ultimate, I think, in a long line. I mean, everything I have said over the last 5 years has been corroborated multiple times by the documents from within the company I work for, as well as within the industry. So that to me was a vindication. The movie was sort of like icing on the cake, an additional vindication. It's also raised my ability to do what I believe to do, or want to do, to a different level. Mm. I mean, I get out to see many more kids and as a result of it.
We have several callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. First, line one, Urbana. Hello.
You're mentioning that your choices were affected by wanting to make sure that your kids had health care coverage, I think is an interesting point. And I think that there are probably a lot of people out there who are struggling with their conscience because we don't have universal health care coverage, and you can't afford to make waves at your job if you see something going wrong because you would lose your health care coverage and you can't start new coverage because it's an existing condition someplace else. And I think that that's something else we should be thinking about and listening to what you're having to say. I'm finding your conversation very interesting. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's go again to another Urbana person, line two. Hello.
Hi. First of all, I guess I really just want to thank you for what you've done. In the last 6 years. I remember watching the Senate hearings about 6 years ago and being really amazed what I considered bold-faced lying. And I also quite feel vindicated because there's been a great deal of lung cancer in my family. And so that's really great. But what I really want to know is if you're really hopeful for future tobacco regulation, where do you see this going?
Well, I think the American people, as well as Congress and the Senate, have a charge from the U.S. Supreme Court in January of this year to regulate a product when used as intended, kills so many, addicts so many. And the ball sits with the Congress and the Senate of the United States, and you're part of that process of electing these people to make sure that they promulgate laws and regulations that, that bridle this industry for the first time.
Well, so, how do you recommend then that
pencil and paper, write a letter to your senator, your congressman in the federal government, and urge them to respond to regulating this industry and making sure that the additives are disclosed, the deliveries are disclosed, the monikers of light and ultralighter are changed, and lots of things that make this industry much more social responsible to the people they addict.
All right. Thank you.
All right. And to Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask something about the genetic effects of smoking. Some years ago, I was involved in getting a lot of background on indoor air pollution, and I ran across the report of an article, and unfortunately, I don't remember too many of the particulars. If I'd known I was never going to see it again, I would have been more careful about documenting it. But this was some research which purported to show that children of smoking fathers had 50 or 60% more cancer of all kinds than children of non-smoking fathers, and children of smoking mothers had 2 to 2.5 times as much leukemia and lymphoma as other people.
Yeah, we clearly know that smoking, both smoke and secondhand smoke, is a class A carcinogen. We know that it has dramatic effects, particularly on developing biological systems of children. And children that are exposed to environmental tobacco smoke become smokers earlier. They're much more fastidiously addicted. And it's truly a health risk for children. And it's also a health risk for those that are adults and also have asthma and respiratory diseases. The genetic link is not, I think you're probably choosing the wrong word here. I think it's an environmental exposure to a carcinogen just as toxic as asbestos and benzene. Secondhand smoke. So smoke-free environments has a lot to do. Smoking moms and dads have a lot to do. 25% of our pregnant population in this country continue to smoke, even though the outcomes from a pregnancy of a woman who smokes is dramatic in terms of low birth weight and respiratory illness and issues. So we have lots to do, and I think you're right in what some of the things you've said, but I think there's a lot more to this picture now that one needs to shine a light on.
Well, I'm sorry to say that at this point we're going to have to stop because we're out of time. For people who are interested in reading some more about our guest, about his organization, Smoke Free Kids, about this whole issue of tobacco and health, one place you might start is with his own website, which is www.jeffreywigand.com. And I'm sure there's lots and lots of other information there on the web, but that's one place that you might go.
It's a good place to start.
Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the audience and time.